Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 207 on Nashville, Tennessee real estate development with HBG Capital founder, Brandon Cobb. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today's guest, Nashville, Tennessee real estate investor Brandon Cobb, is the founder of HBG Capital. He's also a licensed and bonded general contractor in Tennessee, managing more than $10 million of new development each year. Investing in Nashville, Tennessee real estate is like most of the U.S. at the time of this recording. Super low inventory combined with an insanely inflationary environment. There's also a housing shortage which has created profitable conditions for residential real estate developers who are capable of building with scarce and expensive building materials and labor. Not an easy task. On today's episode, Brandon and I discuss this situation and the system he's developed to actually build profitably. Shall we begin?
All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Brandon. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I appreciate you having me on. It's good to see you.
Yeah, for sure. A couple of things I like to start off with. First is a location stamp, because we have people in different markets from all around the country. And I think the context of specific markets, of course, it's cool if you're sitting in Tahiti right now and you say, yeah, I'm on vacation sipping Mai Tais out of whatever the umbrella drinks. But more the context of where people are coming from and their specific markets around the country, I think it's interesting on the show to be able to kind of hear the person from this market, this market, this market, and they bring a different strategy and a different thought process and maybe some of the nuance of their market that is, I find interesting personally, and I assume the listeners do. So whereabouts are you operating from, maybe even grew up, Brandon?
Yeah, so I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, originally born in Panama City, Florida, moved to Memphis, knew I had to get out of there, went to school in Knoxville, Tennessee. I joked that I was probably there for the worst 4 years of UT football history ever, but ended up moving to Nashville about 7 years ago, and that's where I've been ever since, and I don't see myself moving anytime soon.
Let's stay on that a moment. So the Nashville market versus Memphis versus Knoxville. I've driven through Tennessee, I think, on my way to Florida, but never spent any time in any of the cities. I had another guest, I can't recall her name, on the show, and she does these Airbnb vacation rentals in the mountains in Tennessee. I thought, wow, that sounds like a really cool place to visit. And it's like on this list somewhere that may or may not ever occur. So what's the vibe? What's the feel? And why is it that Nashville is so exciting for you to live now?
Yeah. So, you know, I could probably speak to Nashville more than I can the other markets. I know Memphis is a very heavy rental market over there. You can still scoop up properties for pretty cheap, but you got to be really careful because your tenant base is, if you don't have a good system and processes for vetting tenants, you will get hosed on that. Knoxville, you're probably referring to Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge. Tons of cabins going up Airbnb, right? COVID kind of blew that area up. Everybody wants to go on a vacation, but they're scared of COVID or there's a lockdown. So those areas where you can kind of get the whole glamping experience, your cabin experience blew up. That area is phenomenal. And the Smoky Mountains are obviously one of the best places to go and hike, especially during the fall when the leaves change. A little tip for everybody right there. If you've not been in the Smokies during the fall, it's great. Nashville's probably the only city that has, gosh, 30, 40 cranes downtown. So you can just look, if you just had a picture of three cities, you'd be able to identify Nashville from those three because it's got a ton of cranes. Nashville's just exponential growth. There's tons of, I think all the national builders are now officially here. They set up shop and they're building. I mean, you've got these ginormous developments that are being announced every single year. They just announced one. It was like a $2 billion development over in the Bordeaux area, which is your first development where you're going to have like heavy commercial skyscrapers that are kind of outside the downtown core. If you look at Nashville, you got the Cumberland River that kind of rolls through it. And that's sort of your barrier to all this like heavy, deep skyline commercial buildings. Well, now it's starting to get outside of that and it's across the river now. So it's very interesting. And you're going to start to see that area to really kind of explode. So Nashville is just a hot, hot, hot housing market.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting. One of my own personal, when I'm like buying properties to where I put my savings to work, I like to find gentrification tracts and places where the values have this natural boundary pressure happening. So if I go into the city of Philadelphia, there's two rivers there that kind of create a V. And so down at the bottom of the V there is South Philadelphia. And that's been an area that's still in transition. There's a lot of rental market, still some high crime the further down south you go. But that center city is between the two rivers there. And so it creates this like natural boundary where the same kind of thing happened. And most of the skyscrapers are going to be downtown in Philadelphia on one side of the river there, right? And then with University of Penn, we started to see some of that stuff kind of go. And a lot of it feels like for me, Brandon, there was a time in the 2014, 2015, 2016 kind of era where it felt like you had to buy in those areas in order to get appreciation. And then COVID hit and appreciation occurred in every segment of the market everywhere that we could see. So it's interesting to hear that Nashville also contains that same natural barrier. And we found the same thing in the Chicago market with Lake Michigan and the river kind of a situation the same way. So it's interesting to hear that other cities developed the same way around those water transportation areas early on. And here they are kind of expanding beyond that. So that's pretty cool. While we're on the origination piece of the story here, Brandon, could we also maybe talk about how you got started in real estate and a quick snapshot of what your business looks like today?
Yeah, so a similar background to you is we got started wholesaling and flipping houses. And we got started, let's see, I had a job. I was working in medical device sales. And one day I got sat down and Friday I just left this surgeon's surgery and was excited, thought I was going to get him on board. And then decided to kind of meet up with my boss, met at the Starbucks and he got fired.
Wow.
It's a blessing that the day that's ever happened to me. It was a total shock, but kind of set out on this journey. I had a couple different business ventures that I was trying to do. And real estate was the first one that took off. You know, I started putting up these little "we buy houses" signs on telephone poles, kind of call. And it was a foreclosure. We bought it for 90 grand. We put like 10 grand into it, sold it for 130. And we literally just dumped all the profit back into it in the form of marketing. You know, I joke with people that, you know, when we were first starting out, if you've ever seen the Batman movie where they take the big pile of money, the Joker slides down on the big pile of money and then lights it on fire. Like that's what we were doing, marketing dollars. And so all these deals kind of started to pour in. And I had the sales background for medical sales that really gave us a big advantage. And we just started closing a lot of deals. And so we did, I think the first deal we ever did was a flip. The second two were like a wholesale. The third was a flip. The fourth was a new construction project, which was horrible. I was the guy managing it and building it. And I would never recommend someone do that. But what we learned and the failures from that project, which we did succeed, we built it, we sold it. And, you know, investors made a lot of money. I think we lost like $40,000 on that first new build project. Mm. That was what really catapulted our success. So we jumped in and did all this stuff and figured out like what worked and what didn't, started wholesaling. I graduated up into doing more house flipping, invested in, you know, masterminds, coaching. I'm a big, big advocate of investing in yourself. So started paying for all these coaching courses and really just kept dumping the profits back in business. The first 2 years, I didn't even take hardly any profit. I think I paid myself like $30,000 a year. I mean, something that I could just barely scrape by on. And really 2-3 years ago, we started to feel the squeeze with the house flipping market, right? You know, there were a lot of people getting into it. Homes had appreciated quite a bit, but the margins were getting slimmer. So instead of flipping a $280,000 house and making, you know, $40,000-$50,000, we're having to flip, you know, a $350,000-$400,000 house and make like $30,000 or $40,000. And I run profits based on what the retail price is to home, right? I want to be 20-25% of gross. So that really concerned me when you're getting into like 8% margins, you know, flipping these homes. And it was by happen chance one day where we've probably done 7 or 8 new construction projects sort of by accident, where we, you know, show up and the house is like halfway burned down or a tornado hit it. And we're like, well, we can buy it for less than what the land's worth. You know, let's give this thing a shot. All right. Got a bunch of black stuff that's been burnt. Let's just cut out all the black and reframe on top of it and get a structural engineer to come out. We noticed that we were putting these homes faster than we were flipping some of them. Like one of the flips took like 7 months and we built this house around the corner in six. And we're like, wait a minute, we're making $30,000-$40,000 on this $350,000 flip when we're making six figures on this build and we did it in less time. Hang on one second. There's something here. And it was a more desirable product. So at one point, we pretty much just topped the entire marketing department and sales team and said, you know what, we're not doing wholesaling or house flipping anymore. We're just going to go straight into new construction. And when we did that, to us, it was like a blue ocean because we were vertically integrated. We had this need to build out the acquisition arm. Then we had contractor problems. So we built a construction company up and then we grew that. And then we had capital problems. So we started HPG Capital. And when we had everything vertically integrated and we were moving over to this new construction model, oh my God, all the problems that we were having in properties just disappeared. And our, I mean, we like quadrupled the business. I mean, it was crazy. And it didn't take that much more overhead. In fact, our overhead went down because we kind of shut off the marketing department and just pivoted to a self-generation model with all our sales reps. And I mean, it just, things really took off from that point. That's what we do now. We focus on single family new construction in Middle Tennessee, and we target first time home buyers. We like that product because affordable housing is a touchy topic and there's just not much of it. Not to be confused with low income or Section 8 housing. We're targeting first time home buyers that, you know, want an affordable product to live in.
So I have three things here that I'm going to touch on here. The first is the market itself. So I look at Nashville, Tennessee. I look at a lot of markets around the country. The numbers fascinate me. They mean more now. I guess I'm 41 years old and numbers were just like so outrageously large to me. When I got in the business, I remember making $6,000 on my first wholesale assignment and I'm like tap dancing out of settlement. I couldn't believe my luck. You know, the sun was shining brighter. It was just the greatest day of my life. And I wasn't setting the world on fire in life before that. I was 25, 26 years old and was in a bind in life. But anyway, the bigger the numbers, the more I pay attention to the numbers. At first, Brandon, when I'm looking at large numbers, I would feel comfortable. I probably still feel comfortable in certain instances today, like in the first time homebuyer product, 2,250, 3,350 ARV. These are numbers I feel safe with. I'm comfortable with that. And if I start penciling a deal, let's say on this $2 million lot that I'm looking at with a $42 million new construction build for about 240 units out here in Illinois, I look at it, the numbers kind of make sense, but I'm honestly scared of the big numbers and I'm overwhelmed and I set the project down and I say, no, let me just stay back where I'm comfortable a little bit. But one of the things I was going to touch on just a bit was the Nashville population of about 600, 700,000. Does that sound about right still now?
In the Davidson County core.
In the metro area?
If you take into account all the tertiary markets, it's about 2 million.
Okay, so 2 million is the right number there. And as I hear you talk about the inventory tightening up, and I compare a lot of them, I have my framework. It's Atlanta, it's Chicago, and Philadelphia. Those are the three markets that I'm in, and I've watched these three markets behave differently. Atlanta being what I would call like a younger market, meaning it started to come into its own. The downtown core is going to have less skyscraper buildings than a Philadelphia or a Chicago, representative of the age of large scale development that occurred. So some of what you were talking about in that Nashville, where the bigger $2 billion developments are happening now, I would guess that wasn't going to happen at that same level in like the early, in the 80s, when the savings and loan bubble was kind of the Mike Milken era, as the bubble was. Nashville probably wasn't building up at the same level that a Chicago and a Philadelphia was. So it's like, it's like a younger market, kind of like Atlanta was. Yes, there was development. Yes, people were living there. They were moving there. But when we get to the current day and we had this tightening of inventory, what I noticed in Philadelphia and Chicago is that we had a tremendous amount of existing dilapidated inventory because we have Philadelphia that was like settled in the 1700s and 1800s. I've owned houses that were built in the 1800s. I can't remember if I still do. I might. And then I had same kind of thing in Chicago. Chicago is about 50, 100 years newer than Philadelphia, but we're still talking 1800s, massive development that occurred in the 1800s and 1900s for Chicago, a lot of that inventory was still there, and it's still there right now needing to be renovated. And only because we've seen the buoyancy of the market elevate in Philadelphia and Chicago, is it possible for redevelopment now to occur in these areas that were like left behind? So it's kind of a thank God situation for these larger cities that had this excess shadow inventory, this like unusable housing that there. It's in a sense like vacant lots that exist in the Atlanta, Georgia area, right? And we don't have to tear down the structures. We can do the renovations. Now, our renovations in Philly and Chicago are going to be $85,000, $120,000. Like, that's going to be the going, oh, we're flipping a house in a lower priced end of the market. That's going to be more of a first time home buyer area. Worth $250,000, $300,000, you're putting $100,000, $120,000 in renovation in there. But Atlanta, you could almost build a new house for $120,000 on a vacant lot and sell that thing for the same price. So we have less of that existing inventory that exists at all in Atlanta. And from hearing you tell the story and looking at some of the population trend, I would guess, and these are indicative of certain markets probably being a better opportunity for the new construction kind of, and I think new construction is strong in a lot of markets, and there's people building new in Philadelphia and Chicago too, but there's almost not even the option of the existing inventory that exists in the younger city that's becoming overpopulated for the inventory that was ever there to begin with in cities like Atlanta and perhaps Nashville. And I'm kind of out on a limb assuming it's that way in Nashville. Maybe that's your experience already.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding your question. Are you asking about the trends in building and like what the supply is looking like currently?
I think that Nashville tightened up because there's not the level of existing housing inventory, because there was not development happening in 1900 to 1950. In Nashville at the same volume that there was happening in Philadelphia and Chicago from 1900 to 1950. I think a lot less houses were built in the area in general. That's what I noticed. And I know for a fact with Atlanta, because it's a younger city, it's 50 years younger when massive development and population started coming. So we have tons of rehab products still here to happen in Chicago and Philly. There's a lot of work to be done. But I feel like what you're doing is in Nashville, the work is bring it out of the ground. This is where the opportunity is. The market demands it because the other option's not even there. There's not 100-year-old housing in Nashville, just as far as the eye can see, right?
100%. No, you're exactly right. I mean, Nashville really didn't start taking off until like 2011, 2012. You didn't see any super heavy development. It was a small city. You know, parts of like Franklin, one of the hottest cities, Williamson County, you know, best schools in Tennessee. Oh, my God. It used to be all farmland. And now, oh, my goodness, they're trying to just throw up homes everywhere. Right. So you had like a lot of rural areas that just are all of a sudden, boom, you're seeing these big, huge developments. And, you know, these national builders have come the past few years to lay up shop. Now, what's interesting about Nashville is you got like this core, you got this 440 loop that kind of goes around downtown. And that's really like a hotspot. It's where all the millennials want to live, the young professionals that, you know, have money, no family yet, disposable income. And it used to be really bad. You didn't go down there at night, you know? And so you had all these, you know, old dilapidated houses. I think I might have looked at two houses, and I've looked at God knows how many houses that were built before 1900 in Nashville. I think I remember a cabin style one, like 99 in Antioch, Tennessee. So, yeah, we definitely did not have the development that all those other cities had back in the day. So now you do have a lot of dilapidated homes still. I mean, there's still a ton of opportunity there. We felt the squeeze where a lot of people were moving into that market, and we saw the number of appointments that we had to go on increase, the number of offers we had to make increase significantly. And we're just kind of getting priced out. I call it stupid money. You know, people buying things based on just the appreciation play when we were trying to, you know, pay equity going into it. And so that's really what kind of moved us into this new construction thing. There's a really good book. What's it called? Am I being too subtle? What's his name? Sam Zell. Yeah, really good book. He talked about a great indicator for when it was time to go into new construction for commercial buildings was, what's the replacement cost? what can I build this commercial building? Can I buy it for less than I can build it? Great. Then that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy existing. Can I build it for less than I have to acquire it now? Well, I'm going to just do it. It's a simple thing, but you don't really think about it. Right now in the single family space, holy schmuck, it is so much cheaper to build. And there's a bunch of problems with supply chain and all of that, yada, yada. But still, with rising construction costs, it is still way cheaper to build than it is to buy something existing. And that's, you know, that's all we're doing is we're just following the blue ocean. So we'll be in this space until we feel like we're, you know, we're getting squeezed out and we're not getting those 25% margins on our retail price.
For those listeners who may not have read, what was it, Blue Oceans, would you mind defining that so that that term means something there?
Yeah, no, it's, there's a book that was written, guy, in the early like 2000s, definitely not a new concept, but Russell Brunson's kind of come back and popularized it. It's basically when you have a red ocean, there's a bunch of blood in the water, right? Because everyone's slashing each other trying to compete for business, right? Hence the water's red. So blue ocean would be an area where there's not as much competition and you got a little bit more breathing room and your margins are there and you're like, wow, okay, this is a lot more easy to do business over here than it is in those waters over here. We're going to stick to the blue ocean.
Yeah. And it's like, it's an ocean. It's huge, right?
Yeah.
Like that's the visual, guys. Cool. The other thing I want to circle back on is we lose $40,000 on a new construction flip. How did that feel? Like, tell me about, I don't know, before you put the for sale sign out front of there, did you know you were going to lose money? Were you losing sleep at night? Were you pulling your hair out? Like, what was some of the frustration there? Because I imagine people have dealt with that even on a house flip. And maybe they're thinking it's going to be much worse on a new construction, but I want you to touch on that moment of pain there, if there was any, before we get into kind of the solution in the blue ocean of where you're at now with development.
Yeah, it's so funny. We're animals. We react way better to loss than we do any kind of gain. And right now, I have the cleanest books you will see. And the reason I have the cleanest books you will ever see because that new construction project, I was not keeping up with the bookkeeping. I took pictures of whatever receipts I could and put them in my iPhone album. But to reconcile everything and actually figure out like how much money we made or lost, I had to go through like 77 pages of credit card statements and figure out which expense went to where. And it was manual too, man. I've literally printed out. I was buying a lot of the materials on my credit cards and I had like 7 or 8 credit cards and had to print out 12 months worth of statements for all of them and do it. And when it took like 2 weeks of several hours a day of sorting through stuff. It was an absolute nightmare. I do not wish it upon my first enemy. And to do all that work and then find out we were going to lose, you know, about 40 grand on this new construction build that we had spent so much time and effort on. It was a classic situation where I hit the wall. I realized how much a, you know, young, ambitious, motivated, you know, man, boy, can work. You know, I was answering all the phones. I was the project manager. I was in charge of all the marketing, right? I was in charge of paying all the contract. I was wearing all the hats and I was managing, wasn't even a lot. I think I was managing 2 flips and a new build, plus going on all the appointments, plus managing the market. It was a lot. And really, when we had done the dumb thing of putting it under contract before it was built because we're excited. We're like, wow, we got asking price before it was built. So now we had these homeowners showing up every day, like nitpicking everything. And we had given them a date. And when we didn't hit that day, we were like 2.5 months behind schedule. And that's one thing. And when I felt the squeeze, because if I tell somebody I'm going to do something, I have a lot of cognitive dissonance that occurs if I'm not delivering on that. Like I just get stressed out. Then I was getting stressed out because we didn't deliver on what we told them. So then it was like overdrive. So I had to literally stop answering phones. I had to stop going on appointments and I had to just micro focus on finishing this house. And so that's what it did. You know, we had to like cut off one leg in order to save an arm. So we finally ended up building it. And I realized that at that point, I will never, ever again do something that I'm not qualified to do. I pulled it off. And to this day, I can build houses. I can manage flips. I can do it, but I'm not the best. And so that's why I'm a big believer in who, not how. Go find who has been, can do the job that you're asking them to do. And better yet, who can teach you how to do it better? And that's a big rule of thumb that we use these days. We do not hire anybody that can't teach us how to perform the role better than what our current systems and processes deliver. I kind of went off on a tangent, but kind of bring it back home. That feeling of losing $40,000, it was bad, right? You know, it sucked, but I naturally turned negatives into a positive. It's just how my brain worked. And I realized, I'm like, hey, this is just a tuition payment, right? It didn't put me in like a, you know, terrible situation. You know, I had some savings from medical device sales days. And I did a very good job of living under my means for years and saving money. But I was like, I just spent 40 grand to learn how to build a house. And I can say with pretty strong conviction that, you know, had we not gone through those failures, we would not be in the situation that we are today.
Do you remember how you felt when you signed the settlement statement at closing for that one, Brandon?
Yeah, I felt relieved. Yes. Honestly, I was like, thank God, this is fun. Holy schmoly. It wasn't until later that I figured out that we lost 40 grand when I
reconciled
the expenses, geez. Right? Like I didn't know it at that time. I think we actually received like 100 grand on the settlement statement. I was like, woohoo. But then you do all the math and realize, wait a minute, I was 140 over budget or cost or whatever, right? And you're like, oh, wait a minute. So I do remember I was very relieved at the closing table when we sold that thing.
Yeah, we lost 100 and something thousand on one deal. Same year, we lost 150,000 on another deal. The context of putting that in a mental box of a tuition payment is good and making sure to learn from the mistakes. Like for us, we got jammed up on a court case. So we now understand what the risk of litigation is when we're flipping a house or selling a house. So like if you're in some kind of argument with real estate agents or whatever the case is and litigation starts, you may not be able to actually sell that house or refinance that house, land, property, multifamily, whatever, for until that lawsuit is settled. So it's not even the settlement amount of the lawsuit that would be calculated, but the fact that the attorney who understands they're kind of putting the brakes on your project kind of has you by the balls. So that was one lesson we learned from one of the big flips. Another one was the negative power of a busy street. So we had a really nice house, 420 grand, we thought, but it was at the corner so that the large side yard bordered a double yellow, double hot, you know, four lane road there at the end. We sold it for like 365, 350. So we were off by 70,000 and we totally botched a renovation and had flood damage and a couple other things pop up on that one. But, you know, now our underwriting style is now better because of that. We understand the risk because we paid for that lesson at, you know, a much higher level. And of course, people in the network and events says, well, the busy street's going to affect your blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay. We thought we were getting a good deal on this one. I think a lot of people are going to run into those kind of things along the way. But I really wanted you to dig into that emotion and talk through the loss. And I mentioned my loss because I know people are going to have to take a loss if they're flipping property. And thank God my first loss wasn't until, I don't know, deal number 10, 15, 18 or something like that. Whereas I've watched people have the loss on deal number 1, 2, or 3. That's it. They're out of the game. They're like, this is, you know, back to medical device sales and hitting monster.com with my resume. So the pre-sale development, before you talked about this, I'm thinking before, not in the last month or two, but it was like this mental strategy of mine. Oh, here's a low risk way for me to become a real estate developer. I would pre-sell my property. Would you touch on that as an effective or not so effective strategy? And if that's something that you might implement ever again, it sounds like you wouldn't from your story there.
It was a great thing to do because you could get 100% financing with the banks. What a lot of these developers would do pre-COVID before supply chain issues and just wildly expensive construction costs got out of hand is you build a model home and then you pre-sell the whole development. You get 100% financing with the bank if you could bring them a purchase and sell agreement. I mean, that's huge. Not having any of your own money in the deal and just having to cover some of the overhead, that's huge. And then you had this crazy thing called COVID run around, which further depressed the supply of homes and just went bonkers. And so when that happened, I'd say 2020 Q3, Q4, a lot of builders that were either pre-selling homes and locked them in were builders that had locked themselves into a price per square foot contract with homeowners to build their home. they really got hit hard. We didn't pre-sell a ton of homes because our experience was, hey, we can get more, but we did. We tried a few of them. We're like, this is great. You know, it saves 6 weeks on the disposition time. And I'm all about limiting market risk. So anytime I can take a timeline of having capital exposed on the market and reduce it, I'm all about that. But what we realized is we were kind of cutting ourselves short because as we kind of got to the end of the project and the accounting revealed what the true costs were, we're like, wow, you know, construction costs have gone up, you know, 10, 15% here. That's, you know, that's a good bit. And so what we noticed on the homes that we did not pre-sell was the price appreciation of the property was preventing us from taking that construction hit. So it was like, cool, you know, construction costs are 8% over budget on this project, but the home is selling for 10% more than expected, right? So we didn't feel the squeeze on those. So now we don't pre-sell anything. There's too much volatility with construction costs. The appreciation is, it's too much, right? And it's kind of scary how much homes are appreciating. And so as a result, we don't pre-sell anything right now. And we don't build for anybody else too. So we're not locking ourselves into a contract with a homeowner. Like, I don't want to deal with homeowners. I have no motivation to build a home for them. We just build for ourselves. And so we control everything.
Yeah. And I look back, it has not always been this way. From 2012 to 2016, maybe even 2017, if we built a house on a 350 ARV, we would dance a jig if we got 345 or 355. In rare unicorn events, we would get a bidding war and it would sell for like 368. Very rare instances would you have a 20, 30 grand above asking price or a 5, 10% kind of a bidding war, no matter how nice the property was done. And in the past, you know, that did start to change when you got to like 2018, 19. It did start to tighten up. We noticed inventory start to shrink a little bit in some of the markets. Looking back, I wasn't paying attention to those numbers as it occurred. But then when you get into 2020, 2021, 2022, like the method for a buyer who is buying a deal to fix and flip, I think the ones who are smart, who are winning the bids, who we would normally think of like, oh, these are foolish money that's getting in, probably just came out of the real estate seminar, whatever. I think a lot of people, I know I've learned to read the market this way, where I do factor in some portion of the appreciation. Now, for me, I'm not going to do a $100,000 rehab and buy it at an egregious number. I'm going to factor more risk for more renovation. But in areas like Atlanta, a property might need $20,000, $25,000 or less in renovation. And that's paying contractors because the inventory is new there. And literally in the 3 to 5 months that you own that property, if you're 2 months doing the construction, like there's a chance there's going to be another $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in retail price. And I think that a lot of the buyers who are really good at flipping houses, they're paying up on the front end for the house in the as-is condition, but they're really familiar with these little areas, micro markets, which are almost every market in all of the 12 county area or whatever it is for Atlanta right now. And they're riding that appreciation up. And I think it's kind of what you described too, where we don't want to pre-sell things. We don't want to lock them in because the market literally is moving so fast recently. And who knows how long that's going to continue, where 60 days, it's a different story, right? 60 days worth of construction. We're recording this now, March 2022, and the pricing potentially will be 4 or 5% different in many markets if we come on the market on like June 15th. Like that's how fast. I used to pull comps with a 12-month window and timeline. I find myself now it's a 6-month to get a true picture of the market. And then I'm even kind of handicapping based on the month of the year that we're in. So right now, if I'm in March, I have to handicap coming through October, November, and December because there's like this hesitation and unknown with what's going to happen with the market as you go into the wintertime. But now it's January, February, March, and we've always kind of done this seasonally handicapping. But wow, the inventory still hasn't let up, even though the eviction moratoriums and the foreclosures are now being cycled through. We're still not seeing much relief in any of the markets that I track for the inventory. So yeah, I think we probably agree that pre-sale is a great strategy, maybe in a flat, stable, or consistent market. where materials have some sort of consistency, but in this inflationary environment, probably not so much.
I agree with you 100%. You hit the nail right on the head.
All right, cool. So you talk about finding the who, not how. What was that, a Gino Wickman book?
Yeah, I think it's Dan. Is it Dan Sullivan? It might be Dan Sullivan. Gino Wickman, I think, did Traction.
Traction, yeah, okay, okay. So finding the right people for the team. So you're in medical sales, you're running these flips, you're doing this new construction. I can relate, the listener can relate. We've answered the phones, we run the contractors. We want to make the entire pie at first, right? There's going to be a house flip, $30,000 profit on the first one. It's a life-changing sum of money. And I know for me, it took a long time before I could like mentally let go of maybe my greed or my lack of abundant mentality, if you will. Like I felt like, man, I would only find so many of these deals. I kind of wanted to make sure I did the whole thing myself, captured the whole profit. And it took a long time for me to formulate this more collective approach so that my team now exceeds, I don't know, 45 or 50 people, and we're able to do a whole lot more deal flow and each individually make more money than if we were doing it on our own, and make more effective deals and take lower risk and just spread the effort so that more people enjoy it. There's more to go around. There's a larger pie, and we found the right who's. When we talk about the new construction and coming from your background in medical sales, what was that transition like? Maybe there was like a challenging first addition to someone on the team. Maybe that was later in the process, but maybe you could kind of go into the critical key hire and peel apart a couple of details on that.
Yeah, I'll jump into the critical key hire and kind of what shifted my mindset to make that. And I'll kind of tell you some of my mindset before going into it. So I grew up, you know, blue collar before moving to Memphis. I lived in Birmingham. My dad was an HVAC, you know, trying to get into computer stuff. My mom was a school teacher, right? So, you know, we didn't grow up with a lot of money. I don't have some horrible background to tell you where I like came from nothing. I grew up with a lot of love, man. And that's really what got me here. I had a great family. They did the best they could to provide. And, you know, we moved to Memphis and, you know, kind of my dad got a big promotion. So that was nice. We'd be sent to some of these schools, but we grew up with this mentality. I mean, they drilled this into me, like, save your money, because that's the blue collar thing, right? Like, you don't make a lot of money, so save it. So like when we went to dinner, we didn't get like appetizers and stuff. We all got one meal. When the iPhone came out, my dad was like, oh, buy apps, you know, save your money. Even though it was like $1 or $2 per app. I mean, I kid you not. It was drilled into me to not spend money. You know, he was cheap. He showed me how to change my own oil, change my own brakes, wanted me to do a lot of the sweat equity on my car. You know, he knew all the ways to save money because that's what he had to do. That's where they came from, right? And they want what's best for me. So we're just passing on the wisdom that's worked for them. But that is not the right mentality if you're going to start a business. And that's the mentality that I had. It really wasn't until I hit the wall with it was that new construction project. I mean, that pushed me to my limits when I did that new construction project, because I was so far out of my comfort zone and was stressed out financially. All my credit cards were maxed out that I realized, like, I can't do this alone. I mean, there's no way. I'm watching the business crumble, right? You know, we're spending, you know, some money on marketing, and I'm not able to answer the phones now. I can't go on the appointments. I'm like, oh my God, that's just, you know, you're just wasting money, which wasn't like a ton of money, especially compared to what our marketing budget grew into eventually. But, you know, that hurt. There was a lot of pain right there. And, you know, I realized, I was like, dude, we either need to get a blueprint on where we need to go, and we need to do it fast. So I was like, I can't do this whole thing again, right? I can't go through all that again. And so it was by happenstance that I was on, I had talked with my aunt in-law, who was flipping houses up in like Philadelphia, I think, somewhere up there, or no, like Pennsylvania. I was like, how did you get into this? You know, what are you doing? I'm kind of starting to do this. I've got some pointers. And I found her on a website for a mastermind. And I was like, wait a minute, what the heck? You're doing a testimonial for this mastermind here. What in the heck? And so I called her up again and she recommended it. And I pitched to my partner at the time. It was like, you know, $25,000. And I was like, oh my God, this is a lot of freaking money. And that's a lot of money to spend, right? Again, save her mindset. And I pitched to my partner, and at the time he was in Colorado Springs, kind of coming in town to visit his girlfriend who's going to school in Murfreesboro. And he's like, dude, there's no way we're spending this amount of money. We could spend it on marketing, you know, we do this, we do that. And he goes to the website and he starts scrolling through and he looks at it and he goes, looking at a testimony, he goes, that's Adam. And Adam is this like big player in out in Colorado Springs. He's like, we're joining this. So toughest bullet we ever bit. We bit it and we paid it. And like the first meeting, we were like, holy freaking schmoly. They were like, they shaved off, you know, $20,000 a year on our marketing cost day one because they had like negotiated pricing for postcards, right? That negotiated like a group discount, right? And I was like, holy cow. And so now we had like the blueprint. We're sitting in the room, we're doing the mastermind event, we're up, we're introducing our business, and everyone's there to kind of give us pointers. And they're like, dude, you're good at sales. Don't leave that. Hire that position last, right? Always hire the position that you're best at last. You right now, you've got a top of the funnel problem. You're not able to answer the phone. You need to hire a lead intake. And so that's what I did. I was like, boom. Like if I'm very good at taking other people's advice, like I'm a pretty humble guy. I try to remove my ego from every decision that I make. And if someone tells me I need to do something and they've got this big business that I want to copy and replicate, I'm like, boom, done. So that's what we did. That was the first hire. And that's kind of how I arrived at that first hire. From that point, after I hired her, you know, I was like, I've got to hire a project manager because I'm not doing this again. So we hired a project manager. And so we had the blueprint because we took the org charts from these big boys and literally just slowly started filling all the roles.
Nice. What was the key in hiring a project manager? This is something you weren't good at. So how did you identify the person for that role?
How do we do it now, or how did I do it back then? Because it's two completely different ways of going about it.
It's probably more effective to talk about how it's done now.
Yeah. So now we have a whole process. Back then, I was like, cool, your resume says construction. Like, you know, bring you on board, we're hired. We're very fast to hire, slow to fire. And now it's flip-flop, right? Everyone's heard of fast to fire, slow to hire. And so our hiring process, we're a big EOS fan, but I kind of start from the top. One is we use behavioral style interviewing. So when we're interviewing, we're asking questions that want to elicit the skills and experiences that we're looking for. So we don't ask like, well, what's your greatest strength or what's your greatest weakness? It's if I'm hiring for, you know, a project management role, I might ask, tell me about a time where you had a subcontractor who was slowing down a project. How did you manage that? How did you turn it around? Or tell me about a time where you made a decision to fire a subcontractor and bring in somebody new. How did you make that decision? What was the trigger point? And how did you find a new contractor to bring in? Those are the actual skills that I need, right? So that's what we'll do. We'll use behavioral style interviewing. And then again, we're looking for people that can teach us something about a role. One of my biggest takeaways last year was if you want to hyper grow your organization, you need to hire somebody, which was my old way of thinking, and then train them, right? Mm-hmm. Integrate them into the system and get them good at the role. No, we don't do that anymore. We hire somebody who can teach us how to make the position better. But when I'm interviewing people and I'm hiring, if they can't teach me something about this role, then we're not going to hire them. And that's one big reason why we do a ride along and we do a mock work day. We'll actually pay them to come to work for a day, 2 days, 3 days, on the weekend or whatever we have to, and they'll do a ride along. And if it's a superintendent role, my partner's taking them from construction project to construction project. And I mean, he's drilling them on what he would do, where are the gaps. He wants to see if they can notice all the things that are wrong. He'll personally bring them to problem projects and see if he can find what the issues are, because we need to make sure they can do the job. So those are kind of like a high level few things that we do. And then we start off with a phone interview. It's very quick. It's very brief. We're just trying to get a feel for if they pass the smell test, right? You know, why are you looking for a job? What do you want to get out of it long term? You know, how much pay do you need? We don't want to get to the end and figure out, you know, they're asking for way too much. So just some of the smell test stuff. And then the next step is we are looking for core values. So, you know, for example, one of our core values in our organization is extreme ownership. And so I'm a big fan. I make everybody read Jocko Willink's book, Extreme Ownership. And, you know, I'll ask them, I'll say, hey, tell me about a time where you were working as a group and something went wrong, you know, didn't accomplish something. Whose fault was it? And I'm wanting to see if they're like pointing the finger, blaming other people. the problems, or if they're taking ownership from themselves and saying, man, you know, things didn't go right. It was a team effort, but ultimately it was my fault. And here's what I could have done better. So, you know, growth is another one of our core values. And so I'll ask them, hey, tell me about the past five books or podcasts that you've listened to. You know, I'm trying to get a feel for, do they have that growth mentality? Because everybody in our organization has our core values and they're always trying to push themselves and get to the next level. I'm very, very interested in making sure that they've got the core values. Now, once they've got the core values, then we do another interview that's more of a skill assessment. And this is where I'm diving in. And I want to make sure that, again, behavioral style interviewing, that they can tell me stories that at least on the surface level show that they have the experience in the role. And then if they pass the skill assessment, at that point, now they'll do a ride along. If it's a sales position, it's like, come on, we're going on appointments. Let's rock and roll. If it's a superintendent role or a project manager role, you know, my partner, he heads up the whole construction side of things. He's like, all right, ride along. Here we go. We're going to pay you for a day. We're going to see how you interact, see what you can do. And if they pass that, then they're technically a qualified candidate. And we usually want at least, you know, two qualified candidates before we can make a decision. That's the soup and nuts of our whole hiring process.
Nice. So you got this machine, you're building these new houses. What is your source of funding for these? We touched on 100% financing if pre-sold, and you mentioned that you're not pre-selling in light of inflation. So what does the capital stack look like on your new construction builds at this point, Brandon?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we work with a lot of accredited investors. We have a new construction fund. The biggest hurdle for a developer or builder to grow their business is cash flow. And as a builder, if you're building 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 homes a year, and you're having to put 10, 20% down payment to the bank, plus all the overhead of your project, plus paying the monthly interest payments on everything, plus having to pay for all the overages and everything, you're going to have all your money locked up. And you're going to have cash flow problems. You're going to be like, how the hell do I pay my employees? And it's going to be very stressful, right? You know, that was one of the issues we had when we were flipping houses and kind of doing all, you know, using all of our own money for everything. When we started this fund, all the problems disappeared because we had a product where investors could make a great return and was secured by real estate and it offered all the benefits that real estate has to offer. They don't have to do any of the work of flipping it or managing tenants. They really liked that it was true, hands-off passive income. So what we do with that fund is that fund covers the down payment. It covers, we do a 12-month interest escrow. So there's no way that that note can not be paid for 12 months. It goes right into the bank's account and they draw from it. We're usually in and out of these builds in 8-9 months. So that's covered. And then we charge startup costs. So that fund pays for the startup costs. So those startup costs go to buy like the lumber and the foundation. And from there, we pretty much don't have any out-of-pocket costs. So the investors are making money. We put them in a position where once the homes start to sell, like 100% of the proceeds flow to them until we get them paid back in their ROI. And then our firm benefits on all the remaining homes. So it's a great situation where the accredited investors get hands-off passive income. We get to grow as an organization because we don't have cash flow issues. And it just lowers the risk for everybody because we're able to do these a lot faster, get it out in 8-9 months.
So what does the security look like? The timeline for an accredited investor who's going to put money in, the minimum investment, and what kind of a return would they expect over that timeline?
Yeah, so it depends on the project. Some projects were in and out in 12 months or less. Some is 18 months or less. It just depends. So if it's more of like the land's ready to rock and roll, it's 12 months or less because we're just going ground up. Boom, here we go. And then if we're having to do some kind of land development on there, that's usually 6 to 8 months and then 12 months for the construction. So those are usually about an 18-month turnaround. And what I like about the land development side of things is you've got multiple exits. So, you know, 6-8 months down the road, you've developed this land, you put all the infrastructure in, you put all the roads in it. You have an exit strategy now. You could potentially sell that to a big boy who's willing to, you know, volume and only make, you know, 40, 50 on a house where I'm on six figures on a house where it's not worth my time, right? And if he's going to pay me that, like, it just makes sense for me to go ahead and sell it to him. I've got an exit strategy, you know, 6 months, 8 later. At that point, 6 months, 8 months later down the road, I can say, hey, what do home prices look like, right? Are they projected to what I thought they were? And I can continue doing the vertical on it. Or I can be like, wow, this is a really, really good deal. I'm going to pre-sell if I want, right? If it's stabilized. Or what happened in Q4 this year, I could sell it to a build-to-rent buyer, I mean, that's a whole new buyer that's come out, which lowers a lot of these builders' risk because they can buy the whole development from you with one fell swoop, and it's nuts. So there's different timelines depending on what we do, but it's usually between 12 months depending on the deal.
And what kind of return and security? I mean, are we like first position mortgage with one large LLC that is the fund, and how much of a return are they expected?
Yeah, so the way we've got it structured with the fund is the bank's in the first position, and then all the limited partners are in the second position behind the bank, and then our firm would technically be in the third position. So that's how the waterfall flows as these homes sell. The bank gets their note paid off, the investors get paid off, and then our firm would profit on the back end. As far as returns, I don't know if I'm allowed to like advertise returns or not, but typically in the past, from our past deals, investors have seen healthy double-digit returns.
Nice. So if the market crashes and the bank takes the project back, the investors are wiped?
Yeah, it would depend on where we're at. So if, for example, we build in about a 30% hit, so the home can take a 30% hit and like we're still making money. Anything past a 30% decline, then you start looking into, okay, investors' principal could at that point, or profits at that point, could get touched. If you're getting further, significantly past 30% at that point, then you're looking at, okay, their principal could start to be affected at that point.
Yeah, and like any of these accredited investor kind of things, there's always the risk of the market, of these things, the interest rates kind of going where they go. So what is the right product right now in Nashville, Tennessee to mitigate the risk and be profitable? What is your favorite product to build right now?
I like affordable new construction. Again, not to be confused with low income or affordable housing. I'm talking about that first time home buyer home. We really want to target 385,000 and less, entry level, you know, 1500 to 1900 square feet. We like that because it's very easy to build. We do these cookie cutter homes in these neighborhoods. It's the same thing over and over again. I love townhouses, right? Super easy. You can order all the materials. They're readily available. It's something that's very easy to build. And if we can get in and out of the vertical in 8-9 months with a pretty strong runway, you know, our LTV on a lot of these things is 55% to 65% on a lot of these homes. So we feel very comfortable with the margins. We believe that that gives us a really good runway. You know, if the market does crash and burn, another reason why we're in this asset class is it's the lowest supply, highest demand real estate product there is right now. People cannot find affordable homes to live in, let alone new construction. So with new construction, it's a lot more desirable than your fix and flip project or an older home. It is going to be insulated against market volatility because people tend to push into those more affordable assets when you do have a constriction. When market collapses or whatever, the need to live doesn't go away, right? It's still there. We're going to find somewhere to live. They just are feeling it in their wallet. So what do? They move into more affordable living arrangements, right? That's more affordable housing. So that's where we want to be. We want to be in the asset class that people pivot into when there is a recession, because that gives it insulation that other asset classes don't have.
Nice. What other questions or topics did we not cover but are pertinent for everything that we did talk about so far today?
Oh, man. We talked about a lot of stuff. I can't think of anything. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, me too. Maybe, I mean, we had touched on a couple books. I think I wrote down Extreme Ownership by Jocko Williams being one worth checking out. I think we talked about Who, Not How. What other book recommendations maybe you make to people joining your team, or maybe you feel like are really impactful for single family real estate investors?
Oh, that is a great question. Let me think one second. So Raising Capital for Real Estate by Hunter Thompson. I think that being able to raise capital and deploy capital responsibly is the number one skill you need to have if you want to grow your real estate business. That book's fantastic. Susan Lasseter, Getting the Money, is also a really good book on the same subject. I would highly recommend those two books. You know, Sam Zell's book, Am I Being Too Subtle? And then Building an Elite Organization by Don Winter. If you want like a story, biography that's very entertaining, that teaches the skills as they learn them along the way, those are two phenomenal books. Those will really show you how to build culture in an organization. And Don Winter's book, Building an Elite Organization, kind of gives you the framework. It's sort of a blend between Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, and Gina Wickman's Traction Model, EOS. which is another book that I would recommend. You know, we're a big EOS model fan. I think that taking the tidbits out of that book, it's really built for huge organizations. I wouldn't do everything in EOS and traction, but taking some of the core fundamentals of it and applying it, that's definitely huge. Highly recommend that book. Now, if you're just getting started on your journey, I'm naming all this stuff because it depends on where you're at in your real estate journey, right? These are kind of further along, trying to grow and scale your business. The best thing that you can do when you're first starting out, in my opinion, is change your mindset, right? I'm a big Tony Robbins fan, Awaken the Giant Within, phenomenal book. You really got to train your mindset to be able to handle these things. And so if you don't have the mindset, when those tough times go around, when you lose 40 grand on this new build you spent 8 months doing and you're stressed out, if you don't have like that mindset and you're not prepared, then that's going to be a big issue. You're going to cave and you're going to go back to doing whatever day job that you were doing. So, you know, if we had more time, I could think. I've got a whole library I could probably share you, but I think those are some really good starters.
I know. Maybe instead of asking that question, I'll just tell people, go ahead, turn the camera around and like, let's just get a still shot of the library. But I like asking recommendations and people kind of frame them with, you know, maybe here's the takeaway. And one of the things my mentor always told me is his example, Dan Kennedy, his example was you have to learn how to translate things from other industries, other books, and other people's path to progress or path to success. And you have to learn how to translate those into your own business. And the story that he would always say is it was like, I think it was bank drive-through windows came first. And one of, it may have been Ray Kroc, it may have been Burger King, one of those fast food joints looked at that business, the bank drive-through model, and said, oh, we could do that with food, right? And they translate that idea into the other thing. Because I think a lot of times how I used to look at it was like, I didn't want to read a book on some other type of business if it wasn't specifically for, hey, here's how to flip houses. But once you learn how to like translate the language of ideas from these various places, these books that we read, I think that's one of the things that, you know, really made the needle move for me. And you kind of touched on that, right? It's like Sam Zell in Am I Being Too Subtle? He's talking about buying multifamily housing in tertiary markets. Well, how does that apply to me if I'm flipping houses? Well, you got to figure that out, right? There's something that you take away from his story versus just kind of like watching Sam Zell like it's this unbelievable movie on a screen and nothing applies. It's important to figure out like, how does this apply to me and to what I'm doing? And so I think that's like, that's key to absorbing anything, a podcast, John Rockefeller's story, the books we mentioned here today, our conversation here that we talked about, like even if it's not new construction, single family houses that the listener is doing, there's certainly other things we talked about that could be applicable to anyone's current path there if they're paying attention, right?
Yeah, no matter where you're at in your real estate journey, the best investment you still will continue to ever make will be in yourself.
Absolutely. So my final question, I guess maybe we would have two, but the crown jewel of wisdom. If you could go back to walking out of the office or hanging up the phone when you got fired from the sales job and you could share with yourself one nugget of wisdom, what would that be?
Oh, man, it would be the same thing I still continue to do today is get in the rooms with the people that are smarter than you and that are doing the things that you want to do. You know, I'm a big advocate. I pay to be in rooms with guys who are doing way, way bigger things to me. And, you know, eventually I usually end up being one of the bigger guys in that room years and years later. And I'm almost, you know, teaching the new guys who are coming into that room. I'm referring to masterminds. And at that point, it's like, cool, do the give back thing, but then you got to find, you know, the next level. So, you know, I've really taken that part. I do a lot of conferences. I do a lot of masterminds. I really spend a lot of time trying to figure out who it is that I'm trying to mimic and basically provide value to them and then get the information that I need to take myself to the next level.
Nice. Love it. Brandon, if anyone wants to get more Brandon Cobb or learn more about HBG Capital, where should they go?
Yeah, you know, I'm on Facebook. You can type Brandon Cobb if you're interested in learning how you can participate in getting passive income from recession-resistant assets. Go to hbgcapital.net. It's a free educational content. My whole goal is to provide as much value to people as possible. If you want to set up an introductory call to ask some questions or if you're interested, again, you know, you can go to hbgcapital.net. Look forward to hearing from you guys.
Cool. Good stuff. Hey, I appreciate you giving us the time, sharing of your wisdom and coming on the show.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, man. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Nice. You and me both.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Are you interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? You can sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 206 episode archive categorized by topic. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So in 2021, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 355 houses. We've done 132 so far this year, and we currently have another 181 more in our inventory. So here are three ways that you and I could do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to the best real estate deals that you can buy, fix, and flip for profit, go to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, if you are an accredited investor who is seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. That is how you join my network of private lenders to potentially fund my projects. Number three, I am looking for more solid business partners. That is, additional solid business partners. Those that I have are definitely solid. In Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Phoenix. And the role that I am looking to fill is that of our acquisition manager. Our acquisition managers are like the conductor of each deal. We provide the leads, the capital, and a company culture of consistent training and consistent profitability. In other words, everyone on the team is consistently making money, and our acquisition managers earn the largest split of anyone involved in any of our deals. So if a partnership of this nature sounds exciting to you, please visit careers.diamondequity.com for details and instructions on how to express interest. This is a very exclusive position, only to be filled by the right person who is dedicated to deal making, hungry for a big opportunity, and ready to be a loyal member of the Diamond Equity Investments team. This may be the life-changing opportunity you've been searching for. skills which would move you to the top of the list include sales background, strong follow-up skills, and a quick proficiency with numbers and negotiation. House flipping experience is a plus, but not exactly necessary. Go to careers.diamondequity.com, and maybe I'll catch you on one of my own internal Diamond Mastermind calls, open only to my inner circle. We are at the conclusion. Next up, we have Kim Daly joining us to discuss the franchise business model in today's environment. So I'll catch you and Kim next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.